Welcome to a special episode of the EMS EduCast, which we're jointly producing with our good friend Jamie Davis at the MedicCast. On the line today, it's myself, Greg Fries, and the unusual cast of Buck Ferris and Rob Terrio, and of course, Jamie Davis. And this is a special episode for us because we've got on the line with us Dr. Mickey Eisenberg, who is the King County, Washington EMS Medical Director. He's been in this EMS business for a long, long time. He was, just before we started recording, telling us about some of the original LIFEPAC defibrillators and cardiac monitors, and that there's the LIFEPAC 33, because that's how much it weighed, 33 pounds. And Dr. Eisenberg recently wrote a book called Resuscitate, How Your Community Can Improve Survival from Sudden Cardiac Arrest. And I read my way through that book a few months ago and just found it fascinating. By speed reading, I guess I read it fast, cover to cover, because it was so interesting to me as a paramedic and an EMS educator. And I thought, I've got to get this doctor on the EduCast to talk to us about the book, but more specifically, some of the things he's learned of decades of work on improving survival from sudden cardiac arrest and the implications to EMS educators. And so with that brief introduction, Dr. Eisenberg, if you could introduce yourself to our audience, and then also, you know, maybe just touch on why you wrote this book and what led this to come to be.
Sure. My name is Mickey Eisenberg, and I've been involved with EMS since the late 1970s. I first came to Seattle from Detroit, Michigan, and did my residency and internship here, and had the good fortune to join the Medic One program, which was started by Dr. Leonard Cobb and Dr. Michael Kopis. And then a few years later, the county started a program based on the Seattle model, and I've been connected with that ever since. The reason for the book was really an observation that really has been apparent for almost a decade now, and that observation is that there's tremendous variability in survival from ventricular fibrillation out of hospital cardiac arrest. And by a tremendous variation, I mean that the survival rate ranges from a low of 0% to a high of 46% in a few communities. And that's an astounding variation. And just to fill it in a little bit, places like Chicago have a 3% survival. New York City has 5%. Los Angeles, 7%. These are very large metropolitan areas with very low survival rates. And then you have other communities that have survival rates in the 20%, and then the few that are up as high as 46%. And it raises the question of why is this? I mean, to me, it's astounding that such variability should exist. And it immediately makes one wonder, what are the reasons that it exists? So that was the kernel of the idea for the book. And the book is an attempt to try to understand these reasons and offer suggestions to help improve the situation.
And I felt like the book outlined a lot of those reasons and sort of went through whether if you took a factor, if it plays a role in survival or it's unknown, or if it plays no role in improving survival. One part of the book that was really intriguing to me, and it was right at the start, page 18, the big picture, where you talk about, I'm just going to read this because it was so interesting to me. Cardiac arrest represents about 1% of the EMS calls in any given community, but the management of this 1% encapsulates everything good and bad about a community's EMS system. And I've played a role on my county EMS oversight board and talked to people in lots of different EMS systems, and I've tried to discuss this idea with others about, you know, cardiac arrest survival being an indicator of system quality that you go on to lay out in the book here. And I've gotten a lot of pushback on that, surprisingly, from others, of people saying, oh, come on, Greg, that does cardiac arrest survival doesn't really have anything to do with our quality as an EMS system, or it's such a small part of what we do. You know, you can't possibly extrapolate from that. But it's, you know, sort of integral to the work you've done in the book, as well as in King County. And, you know, I guess I'm just looking for more from you on why your proficiency at sudden cardiac arrest patient care is an indicator of high quality EMS.
Well, to some extent, you have to go back to the very roots of emergency medical service programs. When they began in the late 60s, their main and sole focus was for dealing with cardiac emergencies. And those were, of course, acute myocardial infarction and sudden cardiac arrest. And that really is the underpinnings, the raison d'etre, the reason for existence of these programs starting in the very early 60s. And of course, when the national curriculum came about and as they began to spread in other parts of the country, it was clear that they served an awful lot of other, they provided great benefit for all medical emergencies, not just cardiac ones, not to mention trauma. But nevertheless, if you think about it, what are the true life and death situations that an EMS program deals with? Well, clearly, in my mind, the top of the list is sudden cardiac arrest. And if you can't do that well, if you can't deal with that problem, then why in the world would you think that you could do well in other problems? It is the core, it is the basis upon which EMS programs were established, and in my mind is the major justification for their existence. They're not there to provide transportation to hospitals. They're not. Well, let me correct that. That of course they're there to do all those things. But
right.
But the core reason, the real benefit, I guess the analogy is like a fire department exists to put out fires. They're not there to check fire hydrants, even though they do the latter. And it's the same analogy with an EMS program. They're there to deal with life and death situations, even though they do many, many other things. And I think we should just simply never lose sight of that.
If I can just jump in here, Greg, sorry.
Go ahead.
The other reason I think, you know, cardiac arrest is a type of call that sort of reflects the overall system too, is it's the most easily quantifiable in so many ways. Like, I was having a little difficulty getting my head around this too, but the more I think about it, you know, unlike any other call, we can quantify everything in cardiac arrest, the time of collapse to the time of resuscitation, whether they survive neurologically intact or not neurologically intact. All those things are easy to pin down, where so many other calls that we do are difficult to quantify. So I'm kind of, you know, after giving it quite a bit of thought, I'm kind of inclined to agree that once you nail down cardiac arrest, it's probably a good indicator of how you perform in other areas as well.
Well, I think you've hit the nail right on the head. That is precisely it. You can define the event and you can define the outcome. Therefore, you can easily determine whether the intervention, namely what EMS, EMTs, paramedics, dispatcher, all those people between the event and the outcome, whether they make a difference. And I couldn't agree with you more. That's exactly why it's so important.
I'd like to jump in. I guess I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. I'm in a rural system in Maryland. Our average time on scene is probably between 6 to 8 minutes. And so much of cardiac arrest care revolves around early CPR. If there's no early CPR, the survival rates are so low that it's very difficult to have numbers that are something you want to talk about, because we don't have that many cardiac arrests in a rural region to begin with. And so if you look at our annual statistics, our chances of having a survivor are very slim, because we don't have bystander CPR occurring early enough in most cases.
Well, that is a reality that one has to address. There's no question. Many places do have longer response times, less frequent events, and so on and so forth. But I don't think that's a reason to despair. There are, in fact, very good survival rates in some rural areas. And I think the reasons these programs succeed is they use some innovative techniques. They're very strongly committed to telephone CPR, for example. Some of them are actively engaged with bringing police, state patrol, whatever the law enforcement may be, into the system. So I think there are indeed some alternatives that could make you achieve a higher success rate.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, you know, in parts of Wisconsin and Rock and Walworth County in the southeast part of the state where it's fairly rural, they've done some work just with the call and pump and the dispatcher aided CPR instructions, and that's an area where I think they've seen some big improvements coming out of there. And yeah, I think if you have long response times, it really emphasizes the importance of dispatch or bystanders doing CPR if instructed.
In rural Kentucky, that's all we've. I mean, we have very much similar experiences. There's, gosh, in some areas of our district, is a 30-minute response time, and even if you're trying to coach the people to do CPR, it just they're not doing it for some reason. But I'd like to see some of those programs. I guess one question, these people who are having success with that, I'm very interested in it. Are they doing something besides the EMD flip chart? Are they going above and beyond that somehow?
Well, I think a couple things make some telephone dispatch programs more successful than others. And I think there's really two factors that can explain it. One is some programs are very aggressive in giving the message. Now, that has a good and a bad side to it. The good is that you're going to get CPR started more frequently when it's needed. But there is a potentially harmful side, which is that you may encourage CPR to be performed on somebody who isn't in cardiac arrest. And we looked at that very closely because we have a very aggressive system of telephone CPR. And fortunately, I can say that there were no significant or major injuries to the dispatchers giving instructions in those instances when it wasn't needed. So at least in my mind, it suggests that doing something to somebody, even occasionally paying the price of maybe doing it when it's not needed, ultimately is the better strategy. The other thing that I think is a useful technique is to, and this is tough because it takes resources, and everybody's strapped for resources nowadays, but unless you really have somebody committed to being, one, the champion, and two, doing quality improvement, I don't think these programs are going to be terribly successful. Somebody has to be responsible for training, promoting, and most importantly, listening to the calls and providing feedback to the dispatchers. What could they do better? How could they get the message delivered sooner? How can they identify an agonal respiration from a normal respiration? There's just so many components of it that it isn't as easy as saying, here's your flip chart, guys, now just go for it. It, like anything, it requires constant attention and nurturing to make it succeed.
Dr. Eisenberg, if you could pin it down to one single thing and most in need of being addressed to improve outcomes from sudden cardiac death, would in your experience, would it be public education, CPR education? Would it be improvements to the EMS system? Would it be improvements to the dispatching system? Can you pin it down to one specific thing? I know it's a multifactorial thing, but is there one in particular that needs addressing more than others?
Sure. Well, I think the answer really, there's two layers of answering that. The first layer is the obvious therapeutic interventions that can make a difference. Anything your community can do to shorten the duration from collapse to provision of CPR and collapse to that first shock will undoubtedly, guaranteed, lead to an improvement in survival rates. So that's one answer. In some ways, it's the easiest answer because you can quantitate it, you can measure it, you can see given enough cases that it really does make a difference. But the other answer to your question is far more difficult to quantitate, and I think it lies in the area of leadership and accountability. Somebody has got to step forward and say, number one, what is our current performance? Because if we don't know what our current performance is, how can we ever talk about improvement? So that's number one. And number two, how can we take the steps to make it better? And who's going to see that it really does get better? So that's the tough answer to your question, because, it's just tough to get that kind of leadership. It's tough to get somebody willing to take that risk. It's tough sticking your neck out and saying we can do better, because when you say we can do better, there's an implicit criticism there of saying we're not doing good enough. So it's a tough answer, but I think that's where some of it lies.
Well, I think one of the things, that I would still have trouble getting my head around, and Jamie sort of alluded to this, especially in a rural area, is the time of collapse to the time of intervention. And, we can do a fair bit in terms of public education and public access defibrillation programs, but in terms of EMS response, that's one of those things that requires infrastructure and funding, and is probably arguably the most difficult to achieve, especially in a rural setting. So any thoughts or suggestions in that area?
Well, I don't have any magic solutions for that. There's no question your observation is right on target. The more rural you are, the longer it's going to take. And since these interventions ultimately come down to time, certainly you can talk about telephone CPR, but unless you could come up with telephone defibrillation, we're a long ways from meeting the inherent limitation of those long response times.
You might be onto something with telephone defibrillation. If you could make an iPhone application that would pack enough jewels, so you might really be onto something there.
You have to wonder. You can buy a taser for a few hundred dollars. Why can't you buy a defibrillator for a few hundred dollars?
A taser doesn't have to analyze, though.
Don't forget, it has to be hands-free if you're driving and defibrillating yourself, too.
What's the? I just want to turn this to a bit towards the role of the EMS educator, and what's your experience been out there in terms of EMS educators obviously have to play an active role in terms of teaching EMS professionals as well as dispatchers and bystanders. And, I guess if you could just comment on the roles that you've seen EMS educators take to be successful and sort of what some of those factors are in improving sudden cardiac arrest survival.
Well, here's one suggestion for you, and that is to slightly shift the traditional role of an EMS educator and make every person involved in a resuscitation. And now I'm speaking mostly of the EMTs and paramedics, but the role of the educator could be one to say, okay, here's this patient. Ventricular fibrillation is the presenting rhythm. The patient died. Now, why did they die? And begin to make everybody involved in the care asked that question of what was it about this cardiac resuscitation that led to this person dying? Why didn't they live? So that if the educator could somehow do a slight shift in expectations and create the concept that VF is not only a survivable rhythm, but should survive. And if they didn't survive, then everybody involved in the care of that patient should ask that question, why didn't this patient survive? Now, that's a little untraditional role for an educator. It's not teaching skills, techniques, facts. It's instead teaching a sort of approach. And the approach to somebody who has VF arrest should be one of, if this patient didn't live, what was the reason?
Well, that would make for a good, I was just thinking of our research and professionalism course that would make a good case for a fishbone diagram going through kind of the quality assurance process with students. That would be a good exercise.
Well, And, you know, I guess the sort of premise or argument you make in the book is about the theoretical survival of witnessed VFib. It could be as high as 50%. And, you know, there's that the mind shift of, well, it was their turn, or, you know, their time was up, to, you know, we had a 50-50 chance of making a save here. Let's look back and try to figure out what would have made the difference.
Yes, I think the overall community survival rate could probably reach a theoretical maximum of 60-65%. But then within it are sort of different groups. For example, a cardiac arrest in a public location, probably 75% survival rate is not at all unreasonable to achieve. I once had a cardiologist teach the concept that ventricular fibrillation is a benign rhythm disturbance. And the concept that he was trying to put forth is that all it takes is a little bit of electricity delivered quickly enough, and that patient's going to wake up and be perfectly normal. And that is really the essence of managing ventricular fibrillation. So if we can do that, and if we begin to, have that expectation, then it should begin to drive some of the ways we approach this problem.
I would imagine it's just jaw-dropping, though, in systems where they're, you know, in the 0 to 5% save range, to be told, like, well, with the, you know, following the right steps, you could hit as high as 70% for, you know, witnessed cardiac arrest in a public place. And it just seems like that would be such an astounding change that it might be overwhelming for a system to even try.
Well, what a nice overwhelming surprise it would be. But again, I think it really does come back to the fact that most communities in this nation do not know how they're performing now. And without that very basic first step, it's impossible to talk about making things any better. All of those large urban communities that have those very poor survival rates were studies conducted by usually medical directors at the time. And I spoke to many of them, and I asked them, what was the consequence of this study? You know, when Chicago learned they had a 3% survival rate, what happened? When Detroit learned they had virtually zero survival rate, wasn't this a gigantic story in the Detroit press? And amazingly enough, there were little bursts of interest, but it immediately disappeared. And in fact, in the Detroit situation, there was virtually no press coverage of the fact whatsoever. So not only are these low survival rates troubling, but at least you can give credit to these communities for having the courage to look at it. But then it's like nothing happened. How do you get community action? How do you get this kind of political or medical leadership? And believe me, I don't have answers to any of these questions, but it does strike me that unless you know what you're dealing with, you can't begin to talk about improvement.
Well, that's that kind of led to my next question, but it sounds like it's going to have a sad answer. Obviously, you guys have some secret sauce in your neck of the woods to get the public the public into this. I was going to ask you, what kind of programs, what kind of social programs do you have in place to have so many people caring about CPR and available AEDs and whatnot?
There's no question that there were some decisions made back in the 1970s that have really reaped big dividends. Dr. Leonard Cobb and the fire chief at the time, Gordon Vickery, they realized that the time to CPR was critical. They were losing patients because no CPR had started before the fire department arrived. So they set out on a massive community CPR education program. And this is long before there were curricula from by the Heart Association or Red Cross. They just said, well, what should we teach? How long should it take? Let's make it free. And let's provide it to as many people as possible. And surveys now in this community say that upwards of 70% of the population have had CPR training. There's mandatory high school training. There's this, many, of course, places of employment require it. There's this free training offered by the fire department, which says, in effect, you get 10 people together, we'll provide an instructor and the mannequins and come to your house to train people. No charge. So there's no question. The founding fathers of our program made some very wise decisions to create this this community expectation, I suppose you'd call it. And that has certainly been one of the secret ingredients of success.
What are some of the techniques that those educators are using for bystanders? Are they sticking with a 3-hour American Heart Association type curriculum, or have they modified that to come up with something that works well to go into somebody's home for a short period of time and do something where the participants will retain those skills?
Well, your question's right on target. It's like, do we need to train everyone to this level of 3 hours? Can't we train more people by using innovative, shorter techniques? And I strongly believe the latter, that we can cut corners and use innovation to treat the basics. So in addition to the standard course, if you will, there's all sorts of opportunities here, web-based instruction, iPhone applications. We even mailed 10,000 VHS videos to seniors in the community, just saying, here's your free CPR video, go watch it. So there's certainly other techniques that can be used. And we even used the television 30-second spots, the essence of CPR. So clearly a little bit of education is better than nothing at all, and especially now that the chest compression only seems to be strongly advocated by the Heart Association.
It was just a few months ago on the EMS Garage, we were talking about this very subject, and I went off on a anger-fueled rant about that and almost went blue in the face. But yes, there's so many people that have this perception that if you don't do CPR exactly like the AHA wants it, that it somehow you're incurring some sort of liability. And teaching people that maybe compression-only CPR, which can be taught in a 30-second spot, and that was the exact argument I made, was that if you wanted to hit the most people at the most time and do the most good, that you made CPR a public service announcement, and you made it ubiquitous. And lo and behold, in digging through YouTube videos, we even found an AHA commercial that kind of touted that. I mean, it was an AHA commercial saying that CPR is not rocket science. If you don't know what to do, just start pumping up and down. And I've never seen that video or that commercial in this area. And there are so many people that just think that they're stepping into uncharted territory and exposing themselves to liability. I guess obviously you guys aren't feeling that way, but are there any hurdles that you had to go over to adopt these programs that might be not specifically AHA oriented?
No, I can't say that we did face any hurdles, but I agree with your comment. I think that short instructions given to as many people as possible could reap very big dividends. And some of it, of course, is just that recognition of knowing what to do. And I want to put in another plug, if I can here, for the importance of recognizing agonal respirations, because it's present in about probably 30 to 50% of all witnessed cardiac arrests. And it causes great confusion, not only to the public, but to the dispatcher who's trying to sort out, is this person in cardiac arrest or not? And the caller is telling them, well, they're breathing, but clearly it's not normal breathing. And yet that seems to to be a real bugaboo in terms of getting CPR started at the scene.
I can see that. I think in my early CPR teaching days, 20-some-odd years ago, I think all of us taught this concept that if the patient's breathing, any kind of breathing, then they must have a pulse, so you don't need to do CPR. So I think that's something that the heart and stroke, at least here, has not really addressed.
I would agree with you. I think it's underappreciated. It's not stressed. And also there's the reality of vomit, of blood. If a person falls, they could have blood on their mouth. There are just all sorts of realities that should be part of the training, certainly in the course, not necessarily on a 30-second spot, but certainly as part of the course. It seems to me those are important messages.
What are you doing in the dispatchers helping the callers recognize the difference between agonal respirations and, you know, what are some of the kernels or lessons you've learned there to help make that decision so CPR gets started sooner?
Well, the key question the dispatchers are trained to ask is the patient breathing normally, and they really stress that word normally. And if they get anything to suggest that it's not normal, they'll pursue it with the person, describe it. They'll tell me what it sounds like. How often are they breathing? They'll even, on occasion, ask the caller to put the phone by the person in cardiac arrest. So that's number one. And number two, they'll jump in pretty aggressively with instructions. So we encourage that. That is part of their training. And I suppose the third thing is a separate dedicated course or class, 1 hour long, just on agonal respirations, because it is such a bugaboo to prevent instructions being given.
Some of the interesting things have been happening on an EMS level, I found that have just improved our efficiencies have been the use of voice prompting. And this is nothing new for EMTDs, but you know, as someone who's been in the field for 25 years and the last 20 years as an advanced life support provider, we only recently, with the Research Outcome Consortium, the ROC trial, started using our monitored defibrillators in SAD mode with the voice prompts. And I kind of resisted it at first, thinking, you know, this is dumb. I know how to run an arrest. I don't need a voice telling me when to shock and when to start CPR and so on and so forth. But now that we've been doing it for about a year or so, I absolutely love it. And I'm sure it's improved our CPR performance in the field when you've got those prompts.
I agree. Those prompts really are useful. And also useful on the issue of ventilation as well, because there's pretty good data to suggest that people are sometimes being overventilated. And so this is a check on that from happening. If you overventilate the lung, you're preventing blood returning to the heart, and so it could have bad consequences. So go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when I teach ACLS now to groups of physicians and nurses, you know, I tell them about my experience with using the voice prompts, and I tell them, as crazy as it sounds, I really think you should try using the voice prompts the next time you run an arrest somewhere in the hospital or in the emergency or something, because as crazy as it sounds, it works. It keeps everyone on track, and in terms of timing and breaks to check things, it's been a tremendous quality improvement tool.
I agree, and you know, there's fairly good data to suggest that the protocol change by the Heart Association in November of 2005, getting away from the stack shocks to a shock immediately followed by CPR, has led to some pretty dramatic improvements in survival in some communities. And it may be a combination of increasing cardiac return to the blood, to the heart, but I also think it just shows the value of the basics, namely CPR. We've sort of historically over the years evolved to this mantra of shock fast and shock often, and that was probably the wrong thing to do, and we sort of lost the the value of CPR in that equation. And so good old CPR is now back prominently in the part of resuscitation where it probably always should have been.
Dr. Eisenberg, Dr. Eisenberg, when you're talking about overinflation of the lung, are you guys utilizing the rescue pod or some other adjunct to ensure that you aren't overinflating the lung? And have you seen even increases in your numbers through that?
We are using it, but only as part of the ROC consortium trial. It's not our standard of care yet. If the trial shows it to being a benefit, then of course we'll reassess that. But so the answer to your question is we're using it half the time as part of the ROC study.
Okay. I've got a question about on one of the companion podcasts that we're all involved in called the EMS Garage and EMS Leadership. We frequently have conversations about, you know, in the end of the, it's kind of like which vehicles should paramedics arrive at the scene on? Should paramedics be on every fire truck and part of the first arriving crew that gets there in the first 4 minutes, or should that be EMT basics and then paramedics are coming on the ambulance and expected to be there, say, within the first 8 minutes? And I know in King County that the model that's been chosen there is the EMTs basics on the fire trucks and paramedics in the ambulances. I guess I'm curious why that model continues there and whether you see it as more effective, the same, or no difference in improving sudden cardiac arrest care and survival.
Well, I guess I have a biased view on that just because it's what I'm used to and it seems to work well in this community. But of course, every other community will have different resources, different history, different leadership, and so I can't speak for other communities. But the tiered response with EMTs responding to all events and paramedics only to the more critical ones has worked very well for us. There's some data. It's hardly proof, but there's some data to suggest that communities in which paramedics deal with more critical procedures like intubations, central lines, cardiac arrests, have higher survival rates than communities in which the paramedics have lower or less opportunity to practice these skills and manage resuscitations. And so one of these sort of difficult to measure concepts is the skill of the paramedic. And if the skill of the paramedic is important, and we all believe it's probably important, then how do you maintain the skill? Well, one way to maintain it is not to go on every call and only go on the more critical calls. So that's been the essence in this community. It's worked well for us, but it's very difficult to prove something like that, even though we believe pretty strongly in it.
I don't know what your experience, Dr. Eisenberg, has been with the Research Outcome Consortium, but I'm currently a practicing paramedic in my spare time in a region just west of Toronto, and we're part of the ROC trial as well. And one of the things, and not to knock resuscitation of sudden cardiac death, but one of the things I found, which is kind of interesting, this is purely my perception, it's not, but I'll be really curious to see some of the preliminary results of the ROC trial, is that with the change in CPR standards, you know, faster, deeper compressions, fewer ventilations, and a lower tidal volume, add to that, you know, analyze late and the impedance threshold device, we are getting, we seem to be having a higher number of patients surviving cardiac arrest with neurologically intact, but we also seem to be having a much higher of number of patients who have a return to spontaneous circulation who go on to spend a few days in the intensive care unit and subsequently die. So, you know, with all the improvements to EMS delivery of care with the ROC trial, I wonder if this is going to become a serious ethical issue with, you know, kind of over-resuscitation, and whether you see the need for some sort of greater implementation of termination of resuscitation guidelines for services to deal with those patients who probably should not receive all the bells and whistles. Just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, there's no question. The topic you raise is extremely important, and you know, there is a potential dark side to resuscitation, namely resuscitating people who either don't want to be or shouldn't be resuscitated, and these are very challenging and often ethical dilemmas. It does seem to me a few things one could do is to acknowledge the wishes of the patient and not hide behind, I don't have a signed legal document in front of me to withhold resuscitation. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that if communities were to look at their end-of-life issues and ask themselves what should be respectful of the patient, respect their autonomy, that might lead to fewer of the cases like you're describing, where somebody is pharmacologically stimulated back to life, but clearly life cannot be sustained and they die in the hospital.
Well, I wonder, too.
Add to this, though, cold resuscitation techniques. And recently I've seen some town hall meetings, as they're called here in the United States, where these kind of issues were brought up kind of for the first time on a national stage. And just some of the infantile behavior I've seen from the general public over the subject. It's obvious that some general public education about end-of-life wishes needs to be done. All the stuff about death panels and the rest of it, it's obvious that the general public does not understand what somebody can go through if they are resuscitated and maybe they should not have been. I've been very disappointed in what I've seen lately.
Well, I think also outside of those cases where, you know, people say, I don't want my husband resuscitated. He had ALS or something like that. And I mean the other ALS, not the advanced life support kind. I think we will have to take a serious look at clinical criteria for not resuscitating patients as well. You know, like the unwitnessed arrest who's not in a shockable rhythm when you arrive because, again, this is purely anecdotal. But out of the last 9 cardiac arrests that I've run in the past year, I've had 7 cases where there was a return to spontaneous circulation, only one survived to discharge neurologically intact, and I'm convinced it's the improvement in CPR standards and the IED or the impedance threshold device and the analyzed late function. So, even when there's no one there to say this is what he would have wished or she would have wished, I think we will have to seriously look at clinical criteria as well.
You know, I've been noticing that too. I'm sorry, I don't want to jump in. I'm glad to hear somebody else is kind of going through that. It seems lately like we've finally found the secret recipe to at least starting the heart again. I felt like that too, but unfortunately, they come back with sometimes wild tachycardias and some other things going on, and it seems like either they don't really make it upstairs, or if they do, you find out they didn't make it, but for an hour. And in the rural setting, it seems like, you know, you can walk up to an asystole now, use these new techniques, and deliver somebody who's in VTAC or in a PA or even a workable rhythm for a little while. And it's really been a head scratcher for me. I'm glad to hear somebody else is doing it too. But maybe these techniques are kind of reviving people who shouldn't be revived as well.
Well, remember, once they get to the hospital, the hospital in effect becomes the great filter. And people who have anoxic brain damage will sadly die most of the time during the hospitalization. So I'm not sure we're yet at the point where we can decide what will the prognosis be of this person 72 hours into their hospitalization. That really presents a challenge for EMS that I think we're probably a long ways from coming up with.
I was just going to jump in here with one more question before we get into sort of a final thoughts phase, just because of our time limit. And The final question comes to us, actually, Dr. Eisenberg, from a EMT student who aspires to become a paramedic for the Medic One program in your area. And it just has to do with, and you've seen lots of paramedics through the years, and so I guess maybe we could generalize this for, what advice would you have for somebody that's aspiring to be a great paramedic and work in a system like yours or any other high-performing EMS system in the country or, I guess, even internationally?
Well, it's a great choice he's or she is making. I think it's one of the noble professions. There's really nothing more gratifying than providing that critical professional intervention at a moment of crisis in someone's life. I mean, that is truly a remarkable profession to be in. The only advice I would give to that person is to maintain a high standard of excellence, a personal standard of excellence, with every patient that is encountered, from the so-called trivial complaint to the person in cardiac arrest. And that's what the profession is all about. And if you ever lose sight of that, it's time to get out.
Outstanding. I'm sure it's his name is Tim, and I'm sure he'll appreciate hearing your thoughts and encouragement. And because we are nearing our end here, I guess maybe it's just a chance for final thoughts from Jamie or Buck or Rob or comments or questions.
I think I'll jump in real quick since I haven't had too much to say. I've been really enjoying the conversation, and I think it just underlines that it really takes a multifaceted approach, but key to all of that is that there needs to be a leadership from the EMS leaders in the community, whether that's the medical director or the EMS director, but someone needs to take some kind of a lead role in implementing that multifaceted approach from dispatch, community-based CPR initiatives, and improving the training for the providers when they arrive on scene. It's something that has to come from some initiative, and I think Dr. Eisenberg, you said that several times, is that you really need that leadership, and that's the thing I'm taking away from this to kind of improve things in my neck of the woods and work hard with our other trainers here and educators and try to improve things not just in our system but also in the community response as well.
I agree, and let me take this opportunity to say it one more time: it does take leadership. The status quo has such inertia to it that nothing will change unless EMS leadership, medical directive leadership, mayor, political leadership, unless somebody steps up and says, what are we doing and can we do it better? Nothing will change.
If I could just add a couple of final thoughts, I just wanted to finish off my earlier thought about EMS resuscitation of sort of all these cardiac arrests and where we're going with that. Like a lot of other programs, we have the ability to contact a base hospital physician, get an order for pronouncement, and our protocol is run the arrest for 30 minutes and then call. I'm finding with all these changes and improvements that by the time I'm about ready to call for a pronouncement, I get a pulse back on these guys. And so I do think, EMS may need to become the filter, maybe some modifications to the termination resuscitation guidelines or look at things like unwitnessed arrests and, non-shockable rhythms, those being cases where they don't get any resuscitation whatsoever. And then my final thought is just on EMS education. And I think that, one of the things we should strive for is not just competence in running arrests, but proficiency, give students the opportunity to do lots and lots of cardiac arrest scenarios, because arguably a cardiac arrest is one of the easiest calls we do. It's algorithm driven. It's one of the simplest, even though it's a busy dynamic call, it's one of the simplest in so many ways, and one in which, if educators give students the opportunity, they can practice over and over and over again and become very proficient at it.
Yes, I would certainly agree on the latter. There's no question that that skill is pretty vital, and also the ability to think quickly when the situation demands it. That's incredibly important. And let me just go back to the first point you raised about the the need to come up with sort of termination guidelines and or even initiation of CPR guidelines. And I, you know, I agree with what you're saying. It's critically important. And I wonder whether it's almost time for some national body, such as the Institute of Medicine or the Canadian equivalent, to grapple with an issue like this and say, what does the literature say? Are there standards we can come up with? Can we help the people in the field to deal with this very challenging problem?
Well, and, you know, Rob's point about 30 minutes, you know, I work in a system where it's 20 minutes of resuscitation efforts, and I was just reading a determination of death protocol from another urban area that talked about after 15 minutes, you know, care could be terminated, and that, you know, that's a pretty wide range from 15 to 30 minutes, and, you know, I would agree that sort of consensus expert or data-driven guidelines could be really helpful, and also sort of even the, you know, I think another part of this is sort of evening the benchmarking of measuring in the same way. So, you know, if you want to have a conversation about the difference between Chicago or Detroit and Rochester, Minnesota, or Seattle, Washington, that they're comparing the same things.
Yes, I agree completely.
I heard one thing as kind of a QA coordinator at the service where I work at, and something I really want to start implementing, is to ensure the quality of your own employees. I heard of a great system the other day where it was the on-duty supervisor to do a one-on-one debriefing about every full arrest that comes through, not just letting it get caught by QA, having dispatch call the supervisor, said, you guys had a full arrest, and they drive to the hospital, look at the chart, go over the algorithm, sit down and counsel the medic about what went right and what went wrong, and do it right there on the spot and through QA. And I'm fascinated by that kind of concept and quality assurance role, and I'm kind of looking at implementing it where I am, and was hoping maybe this could also be something that the good services could implement.
Well, that's a great idea, and I have a feeling that program probably is going to slowly begin to increase their survival rate, because it's just that kind of attention that really makes a big difference. Let me throw in a plug for voice recording of the cardiac arrest event. I know some defibrillators have that capability. Sometimes you have to pay a little to get that feature, but we have found that immensely valuable. We've used it in our system from day one. We've recorded virtually every cardiac arrest event with not only the rhythm, but with the voice. And that has been a very valuable tool to reconstruct for educational purposes what exactly was going on in the resuscitation when. Because without it, you can't really tell when there are gaps in CPR, you can't sometimes even tell when ventilations are occurring, you can't tell reasons why there was the delay in this or that. And if it's done for the purpose of education and never for the purpose of discipline, we've never ever used these tapes for disciplinary reasons. They've always been used for education. You can learn an awful lot and begin to piece together what went on. One last thought about the program you described where they're debriefing the paramedics. I think that's great. And again, if you ask the question, why did this patient not live if they didn't, you begin to discover things like, well, the dispatcher was doing instructions, but the wife couldn't get the husband off the bed. Or you begin to realize that the fire truck couldn't find the address on the first pass and drove around the block a couple of times. And you begin to realize that dispatcher was confused by agonal respirations and didn't send the medics on the first tone out. So, you know, it's all these things you begin to discover if you debrief every part of that resuscitation that can ultimately help you begin to make the system better.
Dr. Eisenberg, thanks so much for joining us, and we really appreciate it. And of course, we want to put in a plug for your book. I thought it was excellent. It's called Resuscitate, How Your Community Can Improve Survival from Sudden Cardiac Arrest. It's available on Amazon and I'm sure other booksellers online. Where else can our listeners find more information about the work that you're doing and you know, increase their knowledge about sudden cardiac arrest survival or bystander CPR? Where can we find more from you?
Well, the simplest thing is just send me an email. It's Mickey, M-I-C-K-E-Y, dot Eisenberg, E-I-S-E-N-B-E-R-G, at King County, all one word, .gov. And I'd be more than happy to help anybody who writes.
Okay. And I also, you have a site that's got a lot of instructional videos on it. So.
Oh, yeah. We, again, I really love the web as a remarkable tool, but a couple sites to recommend. One is learncpr.org, all one word, learncpr.org. Another one is learnaed.org. There's another site that's called Survive Cardiac Arrest, all one word, .org. And those three sites are just packed with information on the topics we've just been talking about.
Great. Thanks. And we'll be putting those in the show notes so they'll be available on the website. And again, thanks so much for joining us for this special episode of the EMS Educast as well as the Medicast. And thanks also to Jamie for bringing his listeners in and for Buck and Rob, as always, being part of the EMS Educast. Thanks again, Dr. Eisenberg.
Okay. Thanks to all four of you and best wishes.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.